This is an ABC podcast.
Tonight, another surge of new COVID cases in Victoria.
This apartment block is one of nine where residents are banned from leaving.
It will remain essentially under quarantine. People won't be allowed to leave their apartments. They will be allowed out only for a bit of supervised exercise.
This time last year, Victoria was undergoing a dramatic surge in COVID-19 cases, and authorities were struggling to bring the outbreak under control. On the 4th of July, news broke that residents of nine public housing towers in Melbourne were to be forced into a hard lockdown.
I just arrived home and basically I just turned on the TV and I saw Dan Andrews saying that North Melbourne, 33 Alfred Street, was in lockdown.
With no warning, police surrounded the buildings and no one was allowed in or out of the towers.
I decided to look out the window and there were already police starting to barricade, and that was around 2 p.m.
The hard lockdown of the towers attracted a lot of criticism, both at the time and since. At the end of 2020, an investigation by the state's ombudsman found that the failure to give residents due warning breached their human rights.
In my opinion, the immediacy of it was not compatible with the residents' human rights, including the right to humane treatment when deprived of liberty.
Hi, Miyuki Okiranta here, and this is Earshot. As public officials once again battle COVID-19 outbreaks across Australia, the question of how we manage the pandemic remains at the forefront of our minds. 1 year on, Stefan Shepherd, an expert in behavioural psychology, is talking with some of Melbourne's tower residents about their experience of being locked down and locked in.
The public health advice is to close those nine towers. There will be no reason for any of those residents to leave their home for a period of at least 5 days, effective immediately.
I remember watching Dan Andrews' press conference, and the first thing that came to mind was how the hard lockdown would impact on people psychologically.
We don't take that step lightly. We know and understand that it is a big cohort. It is also a group of people, many of whom are amongst the most vulnerable in our Victorian community. But the risk to public health at a personal and family level, the health and wellbeing of those residents who all live very close to each other, the fact that there are positive cases in some of those towers and logical patterns of movement, friendship groups, family groups, mean that the best and most appropriate step is to the hard lockdown in those nine towers. I again make the point that is effective immediately.
I've been working in youth justice for the past decade. I've seen that subjecting people to extended periods of confinement without social contact can be really damaging, especially for those who have existing trauma. And as an African Australian man, I'm aware that it's a problem that disproportionately affects people from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds. So when the hard lockdown effectively imprisoned some people in their homes, I was worried about the effect it would have on already vulnerable communities. For Barry Berry, 33 Alfred Street in North Melbourne has been his home for over 20 years.
You know, the towers, people bought and raised there. Some of the kids that grew up together, they're still all growing up together. So, you know, we play footy downstairs, play soccer downstairs. So it's like, because we don't have a backyard, our backyard is actually the community centre.
Barry is no stranger to overcoming difficulties. Born with mild cerebral palsy, he's worked hard to become a youth worker, a job he loves.
Been a youth worker for like 10 years now. And I work around North Melbourne and Flemington for the living public housing, the age of 16 to 25 year olds. So it's been great fun.
Like many of the residents of the North Melbourne towers, the first Barry heard of the hard lockdown was on the news.
I just arrived home and basically I just turned on the TV and I saw Dan Andrews saying that North Melbourne, 33 Alfred Street, was in lockdown. It's going to be in lockdown at 12 o'clock midnight. I went straight to Woolies, got my essential stuff, got essential stuff for the next door neighbours. I was very concerned on people that who've got little kids. do not have the essentials because, you know, Saturdays and Sundays they go shopping. So I've contacted my cousin who works in a women's health centre. She said she's got boxes of, you know, food and stuff like that, and bread and milk. So I grabbed that and took it to, you know, my house and delivered it to the neighbours basically.
I've grown up in Melbourne, been here all my life, did all my studying here, and I finished that and I went into uni, done a degree and postgrad, and I'm currently working as a healthcare worker.
This Flemington resident, who's asked not to be named, lives on the estate with her three children.
The best things about living in Flemington, I guess, it's the community feel. You've got neighbours all living close by. There's a lot of community networking. There's lots of events that happen in the area that sort of connects people and allows them to make friendships and form bonds. It's having, you know, people to feed back, to talk to, having people for my children to play with. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of good parts about living in this community.
On the day of the hard lockdown, there was a lot of confusion about when the stay-at-home orders would kick in.
We really did not have any warning. We opened the television because we received a phone call from a family member that said that, you know, everyone's going on lockdown. For me, that was, okay, it's starting at midnight, so we had sort of time to go and do some shopping, buying some essentials and whatnot. When we did go down under the building, we found police at every entrance point. So there's two entrance points in the building, and there was about six police in each entrance point, and they were sort of just blocking basically the pathway. And to leave the building, you'd have to show, you know, your license or to show that you don't live in there in the building. The attitude of the police was simply, you need to go back home. It's as simple as that, very simple language, which I thought was really, really ridiculous because I wanted an explanation. And, you know, the minute I said I want more because I don't understand what you're saying and that's not what you've said on the TV, I found another six police officers coming my way, which I thought that was really, I could have stood there and had to go and conversate with them about why they were doing something that's against the law, basically. But I have my three children there who are looking and listening, and I really don't want them to have to see sort of an altercation or any issues, you know, being brought up, because obviously that's going to affect how they look at authority, basically, which I really didn't want to go into in front of my kids. For me personally, I felt belittled. I felt like it was, they were putting you down, in other words, they were taking away your freedom of rights. My human right was gone in that moment, and I did not think that that could actually happen in this day and age.
Masna is 32 years old and a resident of the Flemington Towers. She also thinks that the heavy police presence was counterproductive.
I do believe that the whole lockdown was definitely over-policed. It did aggravate residents. They were doing their job, but at the same time, doing their job also lost that human connection and the empathy or compassion that was needed in this sort of scenario. You know, they were just taking orders and they were just executing those orders.
It's no secret that the Flemington estate has had a difficult relationship with police. There have been episodes of racial profiling, and only a few years ago, a number of residents took legal action against Victoria Police for racial discrimination. For many residents, these experiences are still raw, and I can't help but wonder about the effects of the heavy police presence during the hard lockdown. On the 5th of July, residents woke up to their first full day in lockdown, and they still had no idea how they could access essential supplies, food, meds, all the stuff that we need in life. Masna was worried about people in her building and went door to door finding out what they needed.
We decided to just go and, you know, knock on neighbours' doors and see what their immediate needs were. And for my one of my neighbours who was living just at the end of the corridor, she had four kids and she was actually about to go shopping. And she didn't even know that there was a lockdown. And I told her, I broke the news to her, and she's just like, no, I need to go. I'm like, I need to get nappies for my daughters. I need this, I need that. And I was just like, I'm sorry, like, we can't leave. And I'm like, but I can try and see what I can do. I have people coming who work in community that are going to bring things. So if you just tell me what you need, I'll get them to purchase them for you. And that same day we had colleagues and friends bring a whole heap of groceries, food, and other toiletries and products that we then distributed to residents in the building. And we didn't get through the whole building. I think we got through half the building, and then we had to wait for more groceries and food to come through. And by that time, there was no deliveries from the government or anything like that for people and to meet people's immediate needs.
In North Melbourne, Barry used his social work contacts to try and coordinate supplies and to share information with other residents.
We created like a Facebook page, we created a WhatsApp group basically for them to have a chat and the issues and update of information, and also what sort of resources they need and essentials that they need basically. You know, some of them they needed milk, some people needed, you know, nappies for the kids. So I was holding two phones at the same time, so I was pretty much communicating with people downstairs and people upstairs as well, and seeing and checking in of all the youth, and also checking in all the parents and families basically. So yeah,
in those first 24 hours of the lockdown, residents worked with community volunteers on the outside to make sure that people had access to essential food and medication. But as the official response started to kick in, they were stopped from collecting supplies. This only added to the growing tension between residents and authorities.
I went downstairs and I found my sister downstairs and some other residents, and the local mosque had provided food, and there was about 200 bags of groceries, and some of those groceries were items that people had given money to family members to go out and buy food and then had brought it back, but they had stopped people from taking in those products. And then my sister was getting upset, and she's just like, I paid for that stuff, you know, I need that stuff, my kids are hungry. And then the next minute we see the SES coming and they pick up all the bags and walk away with it. And I started getting really, really upset, and I was just like, people have paid for these things, you know. And I heard that they were taking it so it can be equally distributed and for it to be checked for contraband. And I was just like, hold on a second, we're not in prison. We're being put in lockdown for our health and well-being, not for doing anything wrong or not for breaking the law or anything else, you know.
Listening to the experiences of those people who were hard locked down, it strikes me how incredibly resilient the community was, how they came together and helped each other, like Barry and Masna, who ensured that people got the essential supplies they needed. But there's still a lot of frustration with how the lockdown was handled.
There was definitely a lot of anger. You know, for myself, my anger came across as being let down, of being locked indoors. You know, there are no balconies here and there are no backyards here. You know, Debonairs Park is our backyard, so when people need that fresh air or that time outdoors, you know, you go to the Oval, you go to the park, and the kids play in the playgrounds. But when you're locked down between 5 to 14 days and you can't do any of that, you'd definitely start, I guess, losing it in a sense, and start feeling a bit claustrophobic as well, and just wanting to get out.
And 1 year on, the effects are still being felt by residents.
I really do think there's still ongoing trauma. I don't believe that this can sort of diminish from people's minds anytime soon. I feel like this will continue on. Children will probably remember until they're older. You know, this is sort of an experience that's probably once in a lifetime, something that wasn't expected in my lifetime. So definitely it will be something that will be in the back of people's minds, people that live in these towers for the rest of their lives, which I thought that's as damaging as it can get. And, you know, it's really, really appalling that it had to happen the way it did.
The Ombudsman received more than 85 complaints relating to the treatment of residents subjected to the lockdown. And on the 16th of July 2020, the Ombudsman decided to conduct an inquiry. In her report, Deborah Glass said that the decision to foreground Victoria Police personnel in the operation instead of public health officials appeared to result in significant confusion about the nature and terms of the intervention.
The government need not apologise for taking necessary and difficult action to keep us all safe. But the rushed decision to detain 3,000 people immediately did not appear to have been taken on such health advice.
The report found that although the lockdown was successful in halting the rapid growth of COVID-19, the detention of residents in the towers was not compatible with their human rights, something the state government strongly disputes.
In my opinion, the immediacy of it was not compatible with the residents' human rights, including the right to humane treatment when deprived of liberty.
But I think we need to now ask, was the hard lockdown of the 9 public housing towers necessary?
Now arriving at Richmond, change here for Pakenham Cranbourne.
Just 6 kilometres across the city, on the Richmond Estate in Melbourne's east, last July's COVID-19 response was playing out very differently. The estate's home to over 2,000 of Melbourne's most vulnerable and disadvantaged residents, and it's had its fair share of negative headlines about drug dealing and violence. But as people in North Melbourne and Flemington were being locked down, health workers at the Richmond Estate began talking with residents to identify positive COVID cases and support people self-isolating.
What was so successful, and I think how we were able to wrap services around the residents and provide that support, was the fact that we are located on the estate and the community knew us and actually fondly referred to us as the greenhouse, because our building is green and you go to the greenhouse to get health supports.
Brendan Coulton is the manager of primary care at North Richmond Community Health. He was responsible for leading the COVID-19 emergency response on site.
We had had conversations with the Department of Health about setting up testing clinics for COVID swabbing, trying to understand how far the infection had potentially spread and was the infection in the high-rise estate. The amazing team at North Richmond came in on Saturday, and by Sunday we were open and testing the residents living on the estate. And we had also 5 outreach teams literally door knocking and going from tower to tower and supporting people to get tested. So that involved a significant amount of communication and community engagement through community leaders to, you know, encourage people to be tested. There were quite a bit of resistance from particular cultures around getting tested, but we were able to test 97% of residents living on the estate, which is pretty incredible.
There were 53 confirmed cases of COVID-19 on the Richmond estate, but 2 key factors helped Brendan and his team to contain the outbreaks. One was having health experts embedded on the estate, and the second, their strong relationship with the community.
When we had the positive cases, we had to have a coordinator on every day, and we were able to use our dental staff, who are actually the gurus of PPE and infection control, so that was perfect. And also a significant number of them actually grew up on the estate, so they also had connections to families and friends, and were able to also support with language, so that was an incredible support to what we did. And then a whole range of staff across North Richmond just jumped in to help coordinate and help support the swabbing. So the nursing team obviously were doing the swabbing. We had a lot of staff, again, who have connections to the local community, who were able to correct where somebody lived or a phone number because of that local connection, or someone was already providing services and were able to quickly tell us more information that really helped care for people. One of the things that worked really well for us was being able to get the pathology results back from the testing directly to our GP, Dr. Matt Penn. We've done over 5,000 tests across that journey, and he got every single one back and checked every single one, and we were able to respond really quickly to any positive test and contact and provide support straight away to those residents. That was a significant difference to some of the other programs that were going on at the time, where the results went to a central point and then it took a while for that to come back. The diversity of our community did mean that we had to really be sensitive about different cultures, and we did work out pretty quickly that there was a lot of trust with the organisation, but the trust came through community leaders and the employment of residents off the estate, where they could talk to someone that they knew, that they identified with, and get information in language. There was a lot of cultures receiving news from their country of birth or that they were kind of connected to, and often the messaging from those countries was quite different to what the Australian government messaging was, so that created quite a lot of confusion and quite a lot of uncertainty, so that, you know, communications, the way we presented the information, the way we provided services, the way we provided food and the types of food all had to be very culturally appropriate, and we had to be very sensitive to that. That did provide some challenges. I mean, telling someone from a non-English speaking background that you've received a positive result and you need to stay at home for 2 weeks and you can't leave is, you know, for anyone very challenging. But if you don't understand what that means, that, you know, becomes very complex.
I was overwhelmed as a single mom, couldn't have to have access outside to take my kids downstairs. I'm afraid if I take them downstairs, I may meet somebody who have COVID-19, might get my child sick.
Martha's lived on the Richmond estate for 7 years. As a single mum with two lots of twins, she had a lot of anxiety about how she could keep her kids safe.
All the playground have been locked. Nobody can access playground. And upstairs, I have only small corner to fit in 4 boys who are all fully energized. And I couldn't, my head was off. I'm like, what can I do with these 4 children? They are jumping over the roof and tables. And yeah, it was. I was anxious, overwhelmed, and all this. But it sort of calmed down and cooled down right now. So thank God for that.
Martha's now a liaison officer in something called the High Risk Accommodation Response Team. She's helping Richmond Estate residents to stay COVID safe.
When I was first given this role, it was like a dream to me because it gives me opportunity to be face to face with the community and create events that allows community to come together. And even though it was done during the lockdown, it was done very effectively because, again, we have to introduce all the measures that were there, including the distances and the mask wearing and, you know, mining the gaps and stuff like that. So it allowed us to actually teach people how to stay safe during the COVID, but then create event that will teach people, so look, we can have COVID, but we can still meet together, run event, like Zumba. We've done Zumba, we've done women wellness, which was recovering for those time for the women in terms of mental health and all this that was going on. So it's a very, very exciting role for me, and I've learned a lot and I had a good experience in it.
Laura O'Shea is the program coordinator at Richmond. She thinks that community engagement is key to their COVID success.
Really, at the crux of it, it's about engaging at that local level. Many of them haven't been born in Australia. Their experiences of government can be quite diverse. So there can sort of sometimes be a trust issue with that. And so, you know, receiving sort of government branded information sometimes doesn't help with those local communities. And so being able to sort of really assess locally what, you know, listening to what they're saying about vaccination hesitancy and sort of tweaking our messages, you know, bringing everyone together, providing community forums in language that are delivered by the community leaders on our team, you know, spoken in Somali, in Oromo, you know, in Hakka, etc., is everything. I mean, I think, and we're seeing that. We're seeing that the uptake is really significant at the moment because we have that trust. We employ currently about 15 community staff from just various cultures that predominantly live on our Richmond housing estate, and that has been the absolute number one key success of what we do here. If we did not work with our community, we would not understand the different needs of our communities. And so, you know, our Somali workers will come to us and say, you know, this is what's happening for my community right now. These are the things they're finding challenging in lockdown. These are the things that they need from you guys, or the advocacy through to, you know, for various housing issues or health needs or, you know, childcare concerns or domestic violence issues or whatever it is. And so understanding through our community team, that's been the number one driver of our success.
And funding provided by the High Risk Accommodation Response Program is now also helping to rebuild trust in the North Melbourne Towers.
So my name is Abduasa Abdul Ishmael. But mainly people call me Abdi.
Abdi grew up in North Melbourne and he's been employed as a health concierge. He provides information to residents about the latest COVID-19 health advice, including vaccination.
So health concierge, what they do is basically we work under the buildings, high rises, to provide COVID information, vaccine information, anything to do with health information or anything, because we've been trained for all this vaccine training and everything. A lot of people will feel more comfortable with people they know in the, from the community to ask about anything about COVID and stuff. The residents that are working there, you know, once they see someone from your building or your neighbor, oh, what's the update with COVID? Oh, what's the update with vaccine? That they'll feel more comfortable with you. Yeah, I've taken the vaccine. Now I just got to wait for my next date to take the second dose and everything. I was hopefully, fingers crossed, first dose went very well. Back to work, everything good. So now I just take the second dose, and it's really good taking the vaccine. At the same time, you can explain to your community, you know, look at me, I took the vaccine. When you see someone that took a vaccine, if you're worried and stuff, you get worried less because you're seeing someone that took a vaccine sitting there talking to you, explaining to you. But obviously, if you're talking to people that didn't take vaccine, obviously, you know, you're asking the wrong people. But when you ask the people that health concerned from your community working under the building that taking vaccine, obviously you feel more comfortable.
If there's one thing that the Melbourne Towers hard lockdown has shown us, it's that when things got tough, the residents worked together and took care of each other. But for many, there's still one thing that needs to happen.
Everybody's angry, to be honest, because it was a last-minute thing. People didn't even have time to get prepared. Usually, they always used to give you 24 hours to get ready, but within 1 hour, get locked up straight away. So that was the hard part, you know? So everything was, everybody was just confused. No, there's nothing we could have done. When you see 500 police outside your building, what can you do? You can't really do anything. It's not something that a lot of people forget, to be honest. Because it will take time things for people to forget, but just the government to do the right thing next time and just like obviously apologize to the community and be like sorry. You know, that's what everybody just wants, apology, to be honest.
Melbourne's hard lockdown, 1 year on, was narrated by Stefan Shepherd. It was produced by Lisa Needham and the sound engineer was Brendan O'Neill. I'm Miyuki Okiranta, and join me again next time, within earshot, for another window on the world in sound.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.